This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you want to understand poverty, talk to someone who has lived it. That is the opinion of our guest this hour. She's an expert on the topic because she lived it. Born into a migrant family, married at 15, homeless for 28 years, Dr. Donna Beagle's expertise comes from experience, from studying the topic and devoting her life to breaking barriers for those who live in poverty. She's optimistic about being able to help, but only if we are willing to listen to those in poverty. They have a different take on the world, how it operates, and how it impacts those struggling to make it. And Dr. Beagle is in Charlotte under the auspices of Wingate University and joins us for the hour. Thank you for being here. Welcome to town.
My privilege.
Nice to see you. We have lots of experts, as you might imagine, on this show, and most of their expertise comes from book learning, from studying, from understanding things through other people who tell it to them. But you have lived this experience. So let's talk first about you. And your story. You were, as I said, born into a family. There was no one in that family educated beyond the eighth grade. All of your siblings, I understand, served time in prison except for you. And that's a formula for poverty. Yeah. Is it the formula for poverty or is it the result?
Well, certainly the result. So I was born into the deepest poverty in America, which is generational. So what that means is most of my family members can't read and write. So what kind of jobs are you going to get when you can't read and write? What kind of stability are you going to have? So my family worked hard, but never made enough money to pay both the rent and the utilities.
Well, let's go back in time. Why was your family uneducated? Why were they generationally poverty-stricken?
They were never landowners. They were always workers of the land. So my grandparents were cotton pickers. My parents were cotton pickers. My family, my five brothers, we survived primarily by doing migrant labor work. So we would pick oranges and grapefruits in Arizona, cherries in California, beans, pine cones, moss in Oregon. Had my honeymoon in a cherry field at 15 in Wenatchee, Washington. So we, every day is about you work in the morning, you make enough money to get lunch, you come back in the afternoon, you make enough money to get dinner, and then you go back and do it again the next day.
And there's no way out. From the 30,000-foot view, we can see clearly that there's no way out of that. Can you see that when you're there?
Right. What you learn from deep poverty is hopelessness. You learn that you're not as good as the people who are making it. You don't look like them. You don't talk like them. I said ain't every other word. I didn't know when is it proper to say gone or went. How do people know when to say seen or saw? I didn't even know that I wasn't speaking middle-class sentence structure or using middle-class vocabulary, but I knew that people had a hard time hearing me because of the way I talked. So people would talk over me and about me. I would watch two helping professionals talking to each other about my life. And it wasn't until I became what I call bilingual, I speak fluent middle-class language now, that people began to ask for my opinions and what my world looked and felt like. So I think that's the understanding piece that I try to teach is we really need to understand the perspectives of the people from generational poverty, working class poverty, immigrant poverty, situational poverty. There's so many different life experiences and one word used to describe them all.
Dale, I told you I was going to bring you in later in the program, but I'm going to bring you in now. Dale Molinix is with us. He has firsthand knowledge of those people living in poverty because he's the executive director of the Urban Ministry Center, which is an interfaith organization dedicated to helping Charlotte's homeless population. Been on the program before. Welcome back.
Thank you.
She just said some interesting things, which is why I wanted to bring you into this, because she just said that professionals who were working to trying to help her talked around her, about her, around her, in front of her, I guess thinking that because she didn't speak like they did, she couldn't understand them. Mm-hmm. You must face this every day. How do you and the people who work with you approach that?
Well, it is a challenge because there is a different language and there's a different worldview. We've trained all our folks and we try to train the community in understanding what's the worldview of people in poverty. How do they understand work? How do they understand money? How do they understand time? How do they understand relationships? And it is very different from a middle class point of view. And so if we're in the business of helping people, we need to speak their language and we need to start where they are. It's never about us. It's about the person who's come into our place looking for help. We want them to set the agenda. And so we have to be able to speak that language. We have to understand it.
And he just said something interesting, that they have a different point of view. People in poverty have a different point of view about money. That makes sense. Time and relationships. Do you find that to be the case? And if so, why? What are we talking about here?
Let me give you my master's is communication. And one of the things I teach is that meanings are in people. Words are just symbols. So what does a job mean? When I was 15, my teacher, I told her, I'm quitting school. This has nothing to do with me. Because there was nothing I was being taught that I could apply in the war zone of generational poverty. So my teacher
said...
Not
even math?
No. Teacher said, you need to stay in school because one day you're going to want to get a job, which she's thinking she's giving me a good motivator. But what's the meaning of a job to a teacher? What's the meaning of a job to a migrant labor worker? I saw people work my whole life, hard physical labor, long hours, still get evicted, not be treated with respect, never move up, never ever saw anyone make enough money that they could actually pay the rent and utilities. It was always a choice.
So what good's a job?
So I looked at my teacher and said, I don't want a job because jobs take you away from your family are in crisis and they need you. So my teacher, hearing me say I don't want a job, is filtering that through her middle class experience of a job. You get to have a place to live and you get food in your fridge and transportation and health and you get to maybe have a vacation. So from her perspective, it's like, yes, take this. You want this.
And if you don't want a job, you must be lazy.
That's what she said. You're lazy, you're not motivated, and you're not going to go anywhere in life with that little attitude.
What should she have said?
Well, if she had known me, and one of the things I teach is we've got to understand the passions of the folks who are in the crisis of poverty. So my passion, I thought I was put on this planet to be a mom. And she might have said, hey, Donna, you know what? You want to be a good mom? What if one day your child comes home and needs some help? Don't you want to be able to help your child? I can give you some things that will help you help your child. Oh my gosh, I know helping your children is part of being a good mom. But she can't, if you're using a motivator, an incentive that, you know, a job, I don't talk to people in poverty about get a job. I talk to them, how'd you like to earn a living for your family? How'd you like to buy your mom a house? How'd you like to never, ever see your grandma do without her medicine again? And then I tell them the truth. I tell them, I'm not going to tell you to work hard, you'll make it. How many of you have seen people work hard and not make it? And they're all raising their hands because they have. Majority of people who live in poverty in America are working more than one job and they can't afford rent. So this whole belief system around work hard and you'll make it, people in generational and working class poverty, they know better. So we have to shift our language to the realities that people face and not continue with, well, they're not working hard. Majority are working. Majority of people on food stamps are working. But nobody knows this because we graduate people from college without Poverty 101. I've spoken to 25 years I've been doing this work. I've spoken to thousands of judges, lawyers, doctors, educators, social workers, faith-based folks, business people, and I always ask the question, how many of you have had the course History of Poverty, United States of America? And I never see a hand. And I teach, you know, if we don't know our history, what? We're doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
So what you have is a lot of myths and stereotypes about poverty and the people who live in it. You have the number one teacher of poverty being the media, which are typically dramatized, sensationalized stories that present extremes. So we have so dehumanized people, we don't see them as people. I was on a plane a few weeks ago, and this guy said to me, saw my book, See Poverty, Be the Difference, and looked at the children on there who were living in a storage shed for a couple of years, taking care of an infant sibling. And he's like, well, you know, those people, they don't have any love in their life and they have no fun. And I said, you know, I was born into poverty and we had a lot of love and we had a lot of fun. We just ain't got no money. But that's how divided we are. And we're segregated in the United States. And I'm talking by class.
Right.
So who do middle class people spend time with? So what happens is you get the stereotypes and the myths going. You get folks that are isolated, segregated, hanging out with, you know, if you're in poverty, you're hanging out with people who are also out of salt and butter. So you're not going to be able to learn the vocabulary of the middle class, and you're not going to have their experiences. So what I try to teach is we got to unite and see that we have way more in common as humans. We're not a different species. We're in a different context, and we're responding very appropriately to the world that we live in.
Dale, do you want to jump in there?
Well, one of the things that I heard Donna say that was so clear when we talk with the folks who come to the Urban Ministry Center is, if you talk about the future, if you'll do this, then one day this will happen. For people who are surviving, they just don't think that way. How am I going to get something to eat today? How am I going to stay warm today? How do I stay safe today? And so when we talk about, well, stay in school for 3 or 4 more years, and then one day something good will happen to you, is speaking another language that they just don't understand.
And your story is a good example of that, because you just talked about the poverty that you lived in and the fact that nobody in your family went to school, and every day was a struggle just to make ends meet. They can never pay all the bills all the time, and you got evicted repeatedly. You didn't like school. You learned early on, you say, that education meant stress. The stress of trying to arrive on time, having the right clothing, the right shoes, having lunch, and completing homework projects. And yet your family struggled. To me, that would be incredibly stressful.
Mm-hmm.
So why was education and a way out seen as stress when the life you were living was probably a lot more stressful than going to school every day, wasn't it?
Well, Maslow, who taught us about human development, says that belonging is, for humans, right up there with our need to eat, the need to belong. So as a person who lives in poverty, you walk into a middle-class environment, be it a school, health, social service agency, whatever, and you feel that you are not wanted.
Mm.
You feel it. You're a problem. You're a bother. People don't look up. They don't know your names, your recipient, your client, your student. You don't have a name. But over here in this war zone of poverty, people like me. They know my name, and they're going through the same things I'm going through. So nobody, you know, is, when I say my car got towed because I can't afford car insurance, nobody's going, well, what's the matter with you? Why didn't you get car insurance? They know why I didn't get car insurance, because we're making choices between rent and food. So part of that has to do with, you walk into a school as a kid, you know, our kids in school today, when it's school picture day, who do you think gets the pictures? It's the kids who have money in their envelope. So how does that feel if you're the kid who's standing there with no money in your envelope? You don't want to be there.
No.
How does it feel when the book orders come around and the books come back and the teacher says, oh, you picked a really good book. Good for you. This is a great one. And then walks by you. No, thank you. I don't want to be there. So you have teachers, you have a community who are not poverty informed, who make assumptions about your exposure. All through school, I didn't know the words my teachers would use. They would talk about things, and I'd say, what does that word mean? And they'd say, you need to be a responsible, independent learner. Go look it up in the dictionary. I will not enable you. My doctorate is educational leadership, and now I say, well, why wouldn't you enable me? Isn't that kind of your job?
And you wrote somewhere in an article that you wrote that when you would go to the dictionary and look it up, you'd run into 10 more words that you didn't know what they meant. We have to take a break. Dr. Donald Beagle is with us, a poverty expert, president of Communication Across Borders, and the author of See Poverty, Be the Difference. Also, Dale Mullenix, who is executive director of the Urban Ministry Center. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Foundation for the Carolinas. The 2015 annual meeting, April 2nd, features stories of philanthropy and civic leadership in our region, as well as award-winning photographer Plotin, founder of The People's Portfolio. Details at fftc.org. And UNC Charlotte's Masters in Health Informatics, Jobs for the Future of Healthcare. Registration for upcoming information session at hi.uncc.edu. Fracking appears to be coming to North Carolina. The state's to be set to begin issuing permits in the spring for this technique of extracting oil and natural gas from rock and sediment. Some want the practice banned for environmental and safety reasons. Others see fracking as the path to energy independence and Russell Gold, the senior energy reporter from the Wall Street Journal, joins us to talk about what he has discovered about the process tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. weighs in the anti-tank missiles and small arms to help Ukraine fight pro-Russian rebels. Both sides say they're calling up more troops. The conflict in Ukraine and implications of the U.S. move to provide weapons.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about poverty from somebody who knows it well because she lived it, and she went on to become a PhD with this as kind of her mission in life, to help people understand the language of poverty and be able to cross the barriers. And I just gave the wrong name for the organization that she's president of. It's Communication Across Barriers, not Borders. Also the author of See Poverty, Be the Difference, Dr. Donna Beagle. We were talking about how you hated school when you were a kid, and at 15 you were married. Another recipe for staying in poverty, it seems to me. At 15 you were married, 25 you were divorced with two kids and homeless. But you say that you heard about an educational program to help get the skills to earn a living. Why were you then, after having rejected or been rejected by education, why were you attracted toward an education program that would help this mother of two who is homeless change her life?
Well, at that time, it wasn't that I was directed toward it. I had my lights shut out, which in America, that's a normal thing for people who are in poverty, your water being turned off, your lights being turned off. So I went to a community action agency, and community action agencies actually came out of the war on poverty, Johnson's war on poverty. Mm-hmm. And they're a solid model because they take a both-and approach, not just, here, we're going to help you get your lights turned on, but, hey, we're going to help you get your lights turned on, and here's this brand-new pilot program starting up, and it's designed to help women who are single moms. And I had flat attitude at that time. I was like, I told the woman who told me, why don't you go check out this program? I told her to go do the program. Why don't you go do it? I wasn't in the place I am now. And the reason I went to check out that program was because I not only had my lights shut out, so they said, we'll help you get your lights turned on. I'm driving illegally home. I passed by Pizza Hut, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? I have a 72-hour notice to move, and I have nowhere to go. My mom and dad lived in a 10-foot trailer. Two of my brothers, their families already lived there. I'm about to be on the streets with my two kids. I could go back to work at Pizza Hut. I worked there before. I worked my whole life. But Pizza Hut just took me away from my kids, and they needed me. We still got evicted. So I called the number that the woman had given me, and I went there, and the lady told me if I would complete that program, I would become eligible for a Section 8 housing certificate. That's why I went. Not because, oh, this is going to change my life. I wasn't there yet. At that time, I felt hopeless. I didn't think I was smart. I didn't think I had anything to offer. My whole world was about existing. I need to make it through the day. I need to make sure my kids have a pillow to lay their heads on. That was it. That's all I could think about. But when I got there, they began to teach me that I wasn't stupid. They said, Donna, what kinds of things have you done? I ain't done nothing. Well, wait a minute. You take care of your kids? Yeah. Well, you could run a daycare. You manage money when you have it? Yeah. Well, you could be an accountant. They had me make a list of everything I did in one day, and I did end up evicted and homeless with my kids. So my list was pretty long. And then they said, look, you've done this. This is a skill over here on this professional job description, and here's a title, and here's the pay. And I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking, man, I've done some things. I'm getting taller every day, even though I was homeless, because they were giving me a four-letter word that is stolen for people in poverty, and that's hope.
Yeah, you talked earlier about there not being any hope. But and also it seems to me that the routine, the regularity of being humiliated and being made to feel inferior, whether people are deliberately doing it or inadvertently doing it or just because you feel that way because you're not them, mm-hmm. you are the other, has got to take a toll.
Yeah.
Most people, I would think, who have money, even if they're not wealthy, if they're middle class, if they're able to pay the mortgage, if they go to a job every day, if they're able to put food on the table every night, have no conception of this, do they?
No, and that's really, that was a pivotal moment in my life because I had grown up believing that no one cared. I used to watch my mom and dad go into a helping organization. There'd be plastic or glass between them and the people. And I'd be thinking, why aren't you talking to my mom face to face? Why don't you call her by her name? Do I have bad parents? I remember telling a teacher, seventh grade at a really high poverty school, I don't want to go outside. They fight out there. And she said, you need to go out. I have work to do. And I go out. I get beat up. My hair's fallen out by the handfuls. No one cares. No one cares. And if you talk to people in poverty today, which I do all over the United States, that's one of the first things you'll hear from kids and adults. No one cares. But what I learned when I finally had the privilege and the luxury to be around people who were making it. Remember, I talked about the isolation of poverty. Who do middle-class people spend time with? You're not hanging out with people. When I started being around them in an environment, I began to see them doing caring behaviors. I mean, they were doing things that looked like they cared. And I'm thinking, well, if they care, why are they allowing this to go on in their communities? Why do they allow people to go hungry and live like this? And I began talking to people about poverty. And it became clear they really did care, which Mother Teresa says, to believe your fellow human beings do not care is worse than hunger. And I agree with her. Mm. Once I learned they cared, I also at the same time learned that they didn't have a clue. They could no more describe my life in the war zone of generational poverty than I could describe middle class norms.
So when you go around the country and talk to people, and when you and you're here under the auspices of Wingate University and not under the auspices of the Urban Ministry Center, but when you go to places like Urban Ministry and other charitable organizations where good people get involved, they get their hands dirty, they go in and they try to do what they can do for people in need, be they homeless or poverty-stricken or a mother with four kids and can't put food on the table. Do they, are they doing it? Obviously, they're doing it because they care.
Mm-hmm.
But do they understand the real problem?
No, overwhelmingly no. And that's, again, because we, what I learned is people didn't know. So I started studying where do people learn about poverty. And some people lived it. So, for example, I had a guy in my doctoral research. I interviewed people from poverty who achieved bachelor's degrees. I had a guy say, I'll do your study for you. I grew up in poverty. And I said, well, thank you. So how did your family get by? And he said, well, my father was a physician. He died when I was 12. I went to live with my grandparents. I worked in their store, pulled myself up, became a doctor. Hmm. And I'm listening to him from generational poverty context, thinking, you knew someone who owned a store and you were related to them? You had a father for 12 years who was a physician. Do you know what that did for your vocabulary, for your health, for your networks of support? And it's not to say that's not painful, because who do the children of professionals hang out with? Other children are professionals. And what humans do is we compare ourselves to the people around us. So his peers are not going to live with grandparents. So in his eyes, he grew up poor.
Mm-hmm.
But he actually grew up situational poverty. So if he's not conscious of that, the different life experiences of poverty, and he comes into contact with somebody from generational poverty, he's probably going to say something like, hey, I did it. Why can't...
They will say that. They do say that.
Because
we, and in this country, we provide an opportunity for everybody to get it.
Everyone starts the same. And I bought into that. I get the same messages as the middle class folks in my world of poverty. But I thought that meant everyone had parents who weren't literate. I thought that meant everyone got evicted. I thought that meant that everyone went hungry. I was 26 years old in that pilot program when four middle class women stood up and told their life stories. I had never heard a middle class person's life story. And I'm sitting there going, you lived in one house your whole childhood? You went to one school? You guys didn't get evicted. Your people didn't get arrested. You've never been hungry. You had a doctor. You had insurance. You had credit. And my mind is spinning. And I'm thinking, no wonder you're on that side of the table. And that was when I was able to remove that shame that paralyzed me and see that, you're not better than me. You're just a person who's had different experiences. So I wrote in my little brown diary, I'm going to try to get that GED they're talking about. Then maybe I'll be somebody. Because poverty, especially generational working class poverty, teaches you, you are not somebody.
Wow. You also discovered as part of your experience moving up that sometimes policies, well-intentioned policies, can get in the way of a person moving up that ladder, because you found out that if you went to college as a welfare mother, you would be penalized. And that rule still exists in, I think, all but five of the states in the union. Talk about that for a second.
So I'm in this pilot program. I'm getting hope. They're showing me that I've got some skills that could be used. I'm starting to feel like maybe I could do this, and then I could really take care of my kids. And so I have my action plan for the pilot program, and I go in to see my welfare worker, and I tell her, I'm going to go to school. I'm going to get a 2-year degree in journalism. And she says, you can't go to school. And I had had 3 weeks of being empowered. I was like, I thought, oh, she doesn't understand my plan. So I re-explained it to her, and she said, no, you don't understand. If you go to school, you're not available for work. So therefore, we sanction you, which meant that they would take, I was living on $408 a month. My rent was $395. I got $150 in food stamps. They would cut my check to $258. And I started crying in the welfare office. I'm just feeling like I'm going back, I'm going back, I'm going back, and there's no way out. And I sat there and I was thinking, you know, I can still go to the clothing closets for my kids' clothes. I can go to the food banks for food, and I'll sell my food stamps to pay the electric bill. I'm not going back. Cut me. And she was only doing what we, the public, voted that she do. She's not an evil person. But because of our ignorance about what the American labor market demands, a skill or an education, I mean, we have a labor market that flat shows if you don't have a skill or an education, your chances of earning a living are slim to none. So in the 1700s, in the Pennsylvania area, they passed legislation saying it's illegal to be poor. You have to wear a pea on your sleeve when you leave your home. It has to be red or blue. And they wrote notes like, if you would just make it hard enough on people, they will quit acting poor. Herbert Gans, in his book, The War on the Poor, he says, we keep asking people in crisis to act middle class. And when they don't, we punish them. And that's what a lot of our policies do. So you look at schools. I was working with a school doing a poverty competency assessment. And this teacher said, you got to help me with this kid. I've tried everything. And I said, well, tell me what you've tried. I took away recess. He's not allowed extracurricular activities. I don't let him have any athletics. He's still late every single day. And my thinking is, how many people are on time when they're in crisis? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a luxury to have those bullets of poverty not hitting you so that you can actually be on time. That's a luxury.
Is where there are problems in the public schools, is this the problem?
It's a huge problem. You know, we graduate teachers, too, without Poverty 101, social workers without Poverty 101. So with the best of intentions, there's unintentional harm happening. You know, go look it up in the dictionary.
Because we have an enormous number, evidently, of homeless children in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system. And if a teacher doesn't understand that a child spent the night in the back of a truck,
yeah,
or in a homeless shelter or somewhere much less safe than
it's
that.
It's huge. Well, just yesterday I gave a talk at Wingate, and I had a student come up and hug me and just sob and wrote me a 2-page note that she's homeless at Wingate. So I was in D.C. working with a school, and a little girl came in late, and the teacher said, Rebecca, I didn't think you went to our school anymore. You've been gone so long. And the little girl said, well, we're kind of homeless now. She's like 6 years old. And the teacher said, but did you remember to bring the book I gave you? The teacher didn't hear her. So if you think about it, the way I teach this concept is, how many of you have had a car and got rid of it, got one that was new to you? Before you got that car, how many did you see on the road? And then after that car was yours, how many did you see? They're everywhere, right?
That's
so
right.
Where were they before? They were there, but your perception was not tuned into that. The same is true with poverty.
So you
don't even hear it.
Not only are you not heard, you're invisible.
Exactly.
To a lot of people.
Yes.
People do not understand. Is that partly because they can't understand, because they've never experienced it, or because they really don't want to know how bad things are?
I am convinced that people care. I'm convinced that the hope for our nation is that once people know, They cannot go back. This is my 25th year, and I've trained thousands and thousands of people. I go in and do community-wide work. I work with organizations from all the different sectors, and I watch paradigm shifts. I have people come up to me and say, oh my gosh, I have said that about people. I have treated people that way. I've done those things. And my response is, how could you not? We graduate people without any depth of understanding about real causes of poverty in this country.
So if we did understand, particularly if educators understood, I mean, we're already asking so much of teachers already. If they understood, though, how would that change their approach? How would it change what they had to do every day because they're stretched thin?
Absolutely.
How would it change?
Well, first off, I teach you need a connected approach. Teachers can't do it alone. They can't. They need, I had a teacher say to me who was working in a Title I school, lots of kids in poverty, and she said, Donna, I don't want to be a social worker. I went in to be a teacher. And I said, so how's it working for you? Are you able to do your job? And if not, you don't have to be a social worker. We do overwhelm our teachers. We underpay them. What we need to do is come together as a community and get to know who's out there in the community. So I talk about inventories of community. Who gets a paycheck to fight poverty in some way, intersects with families in poverty and serves them with opportunities or resources? Who are they? Where are they? And what exactly do they do? I need that in my full resource backpack as an educator, as a social worker. And then who in the community cares about people in poverty? Who are they? Where are they? And how could they support my work to educate kids? And then who's impacted? And that would be everybody else. Who are they? Where are they?
When we hear politicians on the stump talking about people in poverty and poverty programs, and when we watch them in office and they're slashing budgets that affect people in poverty, do you see it as malicious, or do you see it as and vindictive punishment for people who just don't care, who don't want to make it, who are lazy, who won't work, or is it simply they don't understand because they've never seen it?
The number one teacher of poverty is the media. Dramatizations, extreme cases, stereotypes. People are making legislation based on that. So you have 23 United States of America who, when a newborn comes into the family who lives in the crisis of poverty and is subsisting on welfare, will provide zero support to that newborn. Zero. Because they're passing legislation that, well, they're having babies to get welfare. Well, what's the truth? What's the facts? 23 states give you nothing if you have additional children. The few states that do give you something to take care of a newborn baby, it's $60 per month.
Well, let's back it up. If you're poverty stricken, why are you having children?
That's one of the biggest questions I get asked. So to answer that, what I talk about is, again, meanings are in people. What does it mean to have a child when you live in the war zone of poverty? When middle-class people talk about having children, what do they talk about?
You tell me.
They talk about, do you live in the right neighborhood?
Right.
So you can go to the right schools.
Where am I going to put my kid?
Do you have the right health care? Do you have the right...
Let me stop you, and we'll come back and finish that thought. It's very important. Dr. Donna Beagle is with us, poverty expert who lived in poverty and the author of See Poverty, Be the Difference. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bojangles, featuring the sausage and egg biscuit, seasoned sausage with egg on a made-from-scratch buttermilk biscuit. Available all day at area Bojangles. And ABZ Creative Partners, marketing and communication strategists committed to helping businesses succeed. Creative, scalable solutions and strategic advice available at abzcreative.com. The U.S. weighs sending anti-tank missiles and small arms to help Ukraine fight pro-Russian rebels. Both sides say they are calling up more troops, and the Diane Rehm Show explores the conflict in Ukraine and the implications of the U.S. move to provide weapons. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
Molly Malibu was
dark,
forest green.
A purple four-door.
He was a burgundy maroon and the insides matched. And my car is making great radio.
Fresh Air.
Morning Edition.
Car Talk.
Wait, don't tell me.
Weekend Edition.
A Prairie Home Companion. And that's awesome.
Find out more about the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program. Call 1-866-789-8627 or visit WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Donna Beagle, a poverty expert, president of Communication Across Barriers, author of See Poverty, Be the Difference. Also with us in our studio here at Spirit Square is Adele Mullinex, executive director of Urban Ministry Center, which we'll talk about in a second here. I want to go back to the question that I asked just prior to the break, and you didn't have time to answer it. If you're in poverty, why have children?
So I had six children when I was living in the war zone of poverty. My first one was a 1 pound, 9 ounce little girl named Joyce. My second one was Jennifer. And then I only have three living children. And I've had eight pregnancies now. I had two children in privilege. They both lived. Infant mortality rates for women in poverty in America are equal to Malaysia. I know some of these statistics firsthand. Nutrition matters. It matters. But
prenatal care.
Prenatal cares. I had no prenatal care. I had no, you know, the only difference when I finally had a healthy baby, my fourth pregnancy, I got to leave the hospital with the baby, was my daughter's Head Start teacher had introduced us to the WIC program. So we had juice and milk. We were living in a car, but we had juice and milk. So why would you bring a baby into that? Why would
yes,
you have a baby? The meaning of having a child when I was in generational poverty, I was going to love them. We are going to play. We are going to sing. And, you know, I'm not really smart, but maybe they'll make it. Maybe they'll make it. They become your hope. Okay, they become your wealth. That's my personal answer. But let me give you my professional, incredibly well-researched Dr. Beagle answer. I looked into the history of humanity, and human beings have been having babies for a long time. All over the world, just because you're in the context of poverty, you want to be part of your own species.
I understand, but this is what really ticks a lot of people off. It is a sense of a lack of responsibility among people who are making bad decisions when they are confronted in crisis. I mean, if you are in crisis and you know you can't pay the light bill and you know you're going to be evicted and you know you're going to live in a car, why are you having children? Why are you doing other things that people would go, you don't need an iPhone?
Well, middle class, I would love to address those because I can. And it's important to address those because those keep us separated. So middle-class folks, when they talk about having children, they talk about do we live in the right neighborhood so they can go to the right schools, which means we know that not everyone's getting the same chance. They talk about do we have the right health care? Do we have college tuition? They talk about resources. Do we have the right car to put them in so they'll be safe? Do we have the right car seat to put them in? If you've never had any of that, how could you know you need it? How could you can't, humans can't know something that they have never been exposed to in a meaningful, relevant way.
But if you know you can't feed yourself, why bring somebody else into the equation?
It's having a child is not, you're not thinking in terms of resources. So let me give you another example. So 1998, I'm married to a senior design engineer who has 15 years in his field. He's never had children. He also speaks French, has a degree in French, amazing skills. Mm-hmm. I am finishing my doctorate. My company, Communication Across Barriers, is exploding. I've spoken in 48 states, 8 countries, all word of mouth. And Chuck says to me, what do you think about having a child? And I said, there's no way we could afford it. Because see, now I've been exposed to what middle-class people get from the womb. You better live in the right neighborhoods. What does it take to be successful in America? You better live in the right neighborhoods so you can go to the right schools. You got to get an education. In poverty, what you're taught is you need to work hard. If you work hard, you'll make it. You're in poverty.
Who teaches that?
It's embedded in the interactions you have. So you get different messages.
But it's not true. I mean,
no.
If it's embedded in messages coming from people in that mm-hmm. social structure, they know it's not true. They know that they can work as hard as they can at 2 and 3 jobs and not pay the bills.
Yeah, but
they know it's not true. So why do they keep spreading it around?
So let me give you an example. America. So we're all, if you're in America, you're being programmed by what does it mean to, what's the value? Well, work hard and you'll make it. So you buy into that. Even working class people who work two jobs subconsciously have bought into something's wrong with me. Mm. That's why I'm not making it. Not, wow, I'm not getting paid a living wage. So you buy into that whole idea that it's you. You're the cause. Paulo Freire, who writes about poverty worldwide, he says, in the United States, because you don't educate people about real structural poverty causes, you're the only country in the world that teaches poverty, teaches people that they are the cause of poverty. We don't talk about that. Like in our last election, you talk about politicians. How many politicians talked about the housing crisis in America? How many, HUD has done a housing affordability study every year and shown there is not one town in this country, not one city in this country that a human being earning minimum wage can afford a modest apartment. Nowhere. So we've got families who are doubled up, tripled up, living in cars and campers, and the latest epidemic is storage sheds. We had a family of seven who ended up in a storage shed. Mom and dad both worked at care centers. Got hours sometimes, not hours other times. The dad builds five beds into the walls of the storage shed. Child welfare finds out, pulls the five children out of the family at a cost of about $65,000 per kid to go into the foster care system. We have an epidemic of kids being taken away because of poverty reasons, not neglect. So if we had been a poverty-informed community, how might have we used those resources? We're spending the money anyway. About $34,000 a year to cage one human. United States cages more people than any other country, and that's both youth and adults.
And most of those people come from poverty.
80% can't read at eighth grade level. Right. Half have untreated mental health issues. So if you go to prison, what you find is it's poverty, poverty, poverty. And New York just released their numbers, $165,000 per person in a cage.
It sounds very Dickensian, doesn't it? It hasn't changed much since then. Let me share some emails that have come in as we've been talking. Trish writes, would love to hear her thoughts about middle-class people who have now transferred down to working class due to unemployment. How to adjust, how to survive, how to bounce back.
Very hard. So I talk about the many different life experiences of poverty. That would be situational. So during the recession, we had a real flood of folks who had never been in poverty who are ending up going and applying for food stamps, unemployment, and being downsized and displaced out of their jobs. And those folks, because they know what it's like to live in a middle-class context, and they know what it's like to have a roof over your head, food in your fridge all the time. It's incredibly painful. So I don't know that there's an answer to how do you adjust, because I think what has to adjust is our communities.
But these people come from a position of power because they understand how the middle class works. They may not be in it at the moment because they've downsized.
Still, it's painful.
But they know how it works, and they could exercise some political
power. That's the pearl. That's the pearl in the recession. I would wish poverty on no one. But the pearl is you had some educated, articulate, fluent middle-class language speakers in our systems saying, why are you treating people like this? Why are you doing these? So shook up some of our systems, I think, to have folks coming through and questioning and challenging and saying this is not okay. But I would encourage you to really begin to look at other skill sets that you might transfer into something that you could get back to the place where you can take care of your family in the way that you need to.
Carolyn emails, I can relate to this. My most painful moment was when my teacher asked me to borrow money for my school fees that my mother didn't have. We didn't have money for even the most basic things. Eric emails, what can be done to change the perception among those who are not, never have been, truly poor, that those who are poor are not just lazy and unwilling to get work?
I think my dream is that we graduate no one without Poverty 101.
Said that several thousand times. What is Poverty 101?
Well, it's basically an understanding of the facts. So if you look at labor statistics, a person who takes a minimum wage job, who is uneducated, unskilled, works for 10 years, the average increase in their income is $2 an hour. Mm. They work 15 more years, they get 25 cents because as you age in the American labor market, you become less employable, especially if you've used your body to earn a living, which is what most people who are uneducated and unskilled are doing. So a high number of people on disability are people who use their bodies for 10 years to work. Their shoulders are giving out, their backs are giving out. And so I think getting poverty informed is critical. Learning the history, I mean, thinking about, you know, that 1700s legislation where we made it illegal for people to be poor. Look at today. We had a Vietnam vet who was on the streets in a wheelchair waiting for to get into a homeless shelter. His name finally came up. He got his bed. He got in the shelter. Well, that night, the police decided to do a sweep of the shelter to see if anyone had warrants or outstanding tickets. Sure enough, he had an unpaid fine. They took him out of the shelter, took him to jail, and what was his ticket for? Loitering on the street while he was waiting to get in the shelter. There was a man in Michigan who was fishing, homeless, caught a fish. He was fined for catching the fish, couldn't pay the fine. Eventually, it's building. They arrest him. They give him 14 days in jail. He does his jail time. He gets out of jail, thinks he's done. No, they give him a bill for room and board. He ends up not being able to pay that, doing a year in jail at a cost to taxpayers of $34,000.
This is insanity.
That's my words.
It's insanity.
It's wrong. But if people don't know, it's like, we can make them pay. We can make them. There's no change in the couch when you're in poverty. You can dig all you want. There's not a penny.
Charlotte, Dale Mullenix is here with the Urban Ministry Center. And Charlotte embarked, I think it was last week, wasn't it, on a plan to end chronic homelessness within 2 years.
Right.
And to start toward that goal, took a census mm-hmm. of the homeless. Have the results come in? Do we know how many people are out there who are homeless?
We interviewed hundreds of people, but now we're going through the data. We've got to clean the data up, deduplicate, confirm information. We do think that our estimate going in of needing housing for 450 chronically homeless people is probably pretty accurate.
I don't mean to be flippant, but is this kind of like the bird count that we do every year? Because it's hard to find people who are homeless. They're not always visible.
Well, this speaks right to what Don is talking about, engaging the community. We had 250 people volunteer to help with this registry, which meant going out at 5 a.m. into camps and under bridges and into abandoned buildings,
right.
looking for people in order to register them so that we would know where they are and who they are so we could begin working toward getting them into housing.
You deal with homeless people every day.
Yes.
What don't we understand about them?
Well, almost everything Donna has said applies to the people that we serve. I think the greater issue that I hear coming out of this conversation is how to engage the greater community. We made a commitment 20 years ago when we were formed that we were going to invite the community to be a part of everything we did. Mm-hmm. What we didn't know—
Have they accepted that invitation?
Oh, we're overwhelmed with volunteers.
Okay.
And what we didn't know is that we thought, okay, we'll accept homeless people right where we meet them, just the way they are. We didn't have the same attitude toward our volunteers. We expected them to come as finished products of compassion, understanding— And they weren't.
They need Poverty 101.
They need Poverty 101. And so what we have done is emphasize, how do I help this person process what their experience is so they begin to understand, well, who is this? Who are the people I'm talking to? How do I feel about it? What should I be doing next? I love one of my volunteers said to me one day, he said, you know, since I've been down here helping, I no longer read the newspaper the same way. I no longer listen to politicians' speeches the same way. I don't listen to the weather forecast the same way because I have neighbors that I didn't know were my neighbors who are homeless.
Wow. You are the project manager for something called Housing First. Is this based on the success we've had with Moore Place, which is a place where we took people who were unstable for many reasons, mm-hmm. not just poverty, but also
right.
because of the addiction problems,
right.
et cetera, and gave them housing thinking, and it's turned out to be true, thinking that if you put them in stable housing,
right.
other parts of their life then become possible to work on.
Exactly. We put them in housing, and we surround them with supportive services that they need. And so the results have been dramatic. The average chronic homeless person cost our community $40,000 a year. It cost us $14,000 a year to house them and surround them with supports that address their health and other issues.
And yet I would wager there is pressure against doing what you want to do versus just doing the way we've always done it.
I'm sure there is. The good news is this Housing First initiative that we started has 26 organizations coming together, including the city, the county, the Housing Authority, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Carolina's Healthcare, the Housing Authority. We've got all the right players at the table. It's a matter of marshaling those resources.
And yet this effort that you're spearheading, this Housing First effort, is really for only 10% of Charlotte's homeless. What happens to the other 90%?
Well, the 10%, we're focusing on them because they're the most vulnerable in terms of health. They also are the longest term homeless, which means they cost our community the most money. Mm-hmm. The other 90%, the situationally homeless, are the folks who, with the right connections to resources, can escape homelessness in a relatively short amount of time. We're focusing on the hardest to serve.
I have about a minute left. I want to explode some myths that you write about, Donna. Many people believe that the poor are getting rich off welfare, to which you say,
my welfare check in 1986 was $408 for three people to live on. Today, a welfare check for three people to live on is $478. Average fair market value rent for $750. If you have a baby while you're on welfare, I already talked about that. Right. The average is $60 or zero.
Many people say there's no hunger in America, as evidenced by the obesity epidemic, you say.
That shows our ignorance about what you can buy on $1.47 per meal, which is what you get if you're on food stamps.
And people who are poor are lazy, and you say,
I've never seen harder workers. Who works harder, the migrant labor worker, the person in their cubicle, person cleaning hotels, or the person in their office? Majority of people, census tells us, that are in poverty are working, and they're working more than one job. And I work really hard to create this opportunity community model that really does include the people who are in poverty, create a poverty-informed community, and get people navigators to resources and opportunities, and I think that's the right track.
You can begin Poverty 101 on your own. You can look at her book, See Poverty, Be the Difference, by Dr. Donna Beagle. That's B-E-E-G-L-E. And Dale Mullinex, if you want to get a firsthand look at this and help out, check in with the Urban Ministry,
Come to the Urban Ministry Center.
Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte.